Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is like the theme song to our most favorite show in the world, Beverly Hills.
Okay.
Okay. You're Jason, I'm Luke. Okay, so you do it to me.
Come on!
Hey there, Beverly Hills 90210 fans. It's now time to dive deep into an episode-by-episode, character-by-character, song-by-song account of the making of your favorite zip code. With your host, Charles Rosen.
I sit in a chair. It's one of Sandy's antiques. The whole thing breaks.
Larry Mullen.
He shouldn't be even in this show. I hope they're going to kill him, and they did.
Pete Ferrero.
My, like, TV crush is Claire Arnold. So, I mean, she has to come on the show at this point.
And representing the fans, Lily Amorim.
Ryan, I love you. I have dreamt about you.
What?
Along with many special guests and your questions. So sit back and relax, because it's, like, totally time for the Beverly Hills 90210 show.
Hey, here we are this week on the Beverly Hills 90210 show podcast, or videocast. Listen, those were a couple of fans, Chuck, that submitted a video to us from way back in the day of them emulating the intro of the show. That was kind of cool, right?
I loved it.
We got a full house here this week. I'm going to start with our usual suspect and Chuck Rosen. Chuck, how is everything going on your end?
Good, because we live in Southern California, not Northern California. It's really hot here, but California's burning again. It's summer, and it's horrible.
It is hot, for sure. And Larry Mullen, I got to see you and Chuck this weekend. That was a lot of fun for my birthday.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was very good.
How's everything going since then?
You know, I have to just do one thing. Indulge me, please. My son, Johnny, got engaged to Stephanie. So that was the mazel tov. And then I got a proof of my second novel, Cayuga, which is coming out soon at LarryMullen.com. And so it was a good week. And I got to see these Dan Attias episodes, which two of them I had never seen. And it just, I don't know how I actually joined the show without seeing these episodes. Thank you, Chuck. But I somehow did, and it was just great re-looking them, because I could really see in context how the thing was growing, and I really enjoyed watching Dan's work, and we'll get into that. But thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, guys, that was Kristen Mack Isaac, I guess that's how you say it. That was her in the hat in the intro. So thank you for sharing that. Karen Rosen, how's everything going on your end?
Well, good. Very good. Thank you. I'm in the same house with Charles. Also keeping a little cooler at the beach than the rest of LA, but we're doing very well.
And then we have Jessica Klein back. Everybody is so excited when you're here, Jessica. So it's
Thank you so much. That's so nice of you.
I think you're going to be with us even some more next week, I think, right?
That's what I hear. You've been kind enough to invite me back, and it's really fun for me to relive these great moments of my past.
Yeah.
Seeing all these shows that I didn't remember, but
only 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And then a little surprise for everybody, Carol Potter is back with us.
Hello.
I don't feel like I'm the host of Hollywood Squares here.
I was thinking.
I know.
Peter Marshall. It's pretty close.
How's everything going on your end, Carol?
Oh, it's been a busy week. I'm finishing up a book. We're doing the copy editing now. So, and it's going to be published in January by the APA. It's called When Your Child Has a Chronic Medical Illness, A Guide for the Parenting Journey. And I've been working with a psychologist in New Jersey. It's been an amazing process, and I'm really excited about it.
Hey, you know, Carol, Chuck and I interviewed the actor that played Josh Richland, who is Joshua Beckett, and he said that you both are, you're connected through your new world.
Is he on the LA POMO listserv? On the LA POMO listserv. postmodern approaches to therapy is kind of my passion. And so there's a whole bunch of us on a big old listserv giving each other referrals and stuff like that. I'm not really taking new clients anymore.
Right.
I'm just trying to
ask you a question, Carol. Were you inspired to do what you do after working with the cast all these years?
I do think it would make a great sort of like sociological study, right? If somebody had followed that cast through the 5 years that I was on the show, and the effects of fame and the different effects on the men and on the women, and how they sort of got into this very giddy place. And then I just remember coming back the fifth season, and it, like, everybody had their feet on the ground. It was somehow they'd gone through it, and then they realized, oh, wait a minute, I have to do this.
Yeah.
I'm doing this, so this is what's important. It was really remarkable. I suspect it was that Jason started the role because he started directing, and when he came back as an actor after having directed an episode, he was a completely different guy. He was the first one on the set after a break. He was just jumping on everything because he saw from the other side
right.
how chaos is created when people are not, when the actors are not, you know, ready to go.
But yeah. he was not one of the problematic late people at all. He was very professional, what I observed.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
But it would just jumped into a whole different level.
No, before he was looking through the DP's lens and just seeing things for fun, but then he did get a more professional approach.
And
I have to say hello to
anybody knows the difference in this cast between the first season and the fifth season. It's our guest who you're gonna now introduce.
Yes. Well, first I'm gonna say hello to Lily, who's representing the fans, hello. Right?
Hi, nice everyone.
Hi, Lily.
Just an aside, Lily. So sorry about what had happened last week with you with the whole Wi-Fi debacle. You're dealing with a lot with the storm and all that, and you missed out on some with Jason. But are you okay now? Everything's okay.
We seem to be okay now. But would you believe that? So we had the remnants of Hurricane Isaias, lost power for 8 days, and then we lost power again. 10 days later, overnight, after there was another powerful storm that came through overnight. So it's just been a little crazy weather here lately.
Well, we've missed you, so it's good. Nice to have you back here. And then now, of course, Dan Attias, director. I mean, Dan, you've done so much great work, obviously not just on this show, 90210. I know you directed a couple episodes of Lost that I'm like in love with. So your bio, man, you've just done so much stuff. So thank you for taking the time in and coming here with us. How's everything going in your world?
Oh, it's going much like probably most of your world is going. It's not like I had to jump through a lot of hoops to make time to be available. But I would have had there been hoops to jump through, I would have, because I'm really delighted to be here. And I just want to say at the outset, you know, when Chuck first called, he said there'd be two episodes we'd look at. And I lamented, well, I have a lot those are nice, but and one I mentioned, Jessica, was Leading from the Heart, which was one of my favorites also. But I looked at five episodes, which was got you sent me, Peter, and it was so nice. And I got so nostalgic and so appreciative of what the show was. And it has been a really lovely experience kind of revisiting that and thinking about the shows and the spirit of the time and the innocence of so many of us and the actors, you know, because it started in season one. I was, Carol, I like you, was also season 1 to 5. And so I'm really delighted to be here.
That's awesome. Hey, Chuck and I got to do, before we jump into this episode, Chuck and I did for my birthday, which was so nice of you. And thank you for all the birthday wishes here in the chat. I appreciate that. We did a episode about locations, and Chuck, you asked a trivia question, and you're saying Ricky Moss got that trivia question right on Facebook, right? Do you want to talk about that real quick?
Right. The question was, what location in the high school years in Beverly Hills did we shoot at twice? We only shot three times in Beverly Hills. That was that location, and then in front of the hotel where Dylan smashes the plant and chases after Brenda when Karen was so ready to give birth. Watching it, and the other was Roxbury Park, where I imagine Dan Addy has probably got a few base hits at some point. We were the American League, Little League, but I think you played there, right?
Right.
Let's see, White Sox or Tigers?
Chuck and I were both are both alumni of Beverly Hills High School, so it was really fun to kind of recreate it, even though not to jump ahead, but it was kind of fun that I think Chuck and I, we were both thinking of the Beverly High that existed in, you know, the late 60s, not the one that probably existed around the time we made the show, but such is life.
Exactly. But, to say that, you know, here, what we did have right at the end in the high school years, we did have the, approaching the Board of Education, and one of the peripheral issues was a dress code. The girls got to come to school in cutoffs and everything because you went in front of the board. And
Chuck, you have a memory.
The young people watching
For Ricky Moss, who got that question right on Facebook, just email me, peter@beverlyhills90210show.com, and we'll find a spot for you to kind of pop in here with us one day, because that's what the prize was. Okay, let's jump into this week's episode. We have some promos and stuff we're going to play through the episode, but Chuck, you and Dan go way back, right?
Yeah.
Way back. We could be talking about kickball. We could be talking about Little League. We could be talking about high school politics. Even Cal Berkeley. We walked the same Sproul Plaza before you transferred back to UCLA.
And
Dan decided not to become Clarence Darrow, but to become a prize director and go to film school. And we had that in common too, because I was also groomed to be a lawyer.
So
we did go real back, and so when we got the original order, the one of the first people I sought out was Dan, because I knew that he had been doing some things. He had done a feature film, he had done been an assistant director for Steven Spielberg. He was someone with already a resume that was very impressive, and he was not available. You were doing the wrestling. You were doing some wrestling show, I think it was, for Gary Levine for ABC, and we had to wait, and it was worthwhile to wait, because Dan comes in, and the first episode we're going to be talking about fans is General Art of Listening, and you have to realize that at that moment the show was in chaos, just like what we got around in Washington right now, but not malicious. We had done the first six episodes, and they were kind of a block, and we got them through, and we did them, and the result of that was that we fired the line producer, who was my closest friend, another Beverly Hills alum, Jeffrey White, and Paul Wagner walked through the door, and Paul was someone I had worked with before and was a veteran and had done television, and we had the one transitional episode, which was produced by both, and that was the 17-year itch, Carol. The last one before Dan came in, and it was really important because, for me, it was personally important because there were, could I really do this? And what about the writing? And where are we going with this? And I remember Dan McDermott, who was the Fox executive, calls me on the phone, says, "Open up the yearbook," and goes through and says, they have this thing called a teen line. And I thought that sounded interesting, not knowing that years later, my daughter Maxine would actually do that teen line.
My daughter too.
And it was very worthwhile. And I wrote this very quickly, and it really was written in the spirit of, I can write you under the table. I know how to write an hour of television. I wrote it in about 3 days. And what I remember first about Dan coming in was that, and the network for the first time would see something we did positively. Mm. There wasn't the pushback, which was a nice thing. And I thank Dan McDermott for that. But also that Dan, when he started this, I remember that first weekend, Dan, and you did something that no other director had done before. And I don't know of how many did after. You walked the sets. You got to know the sets by walking the sets on a Saturday, coming back to the warehouse. Was that your MO throughout your career or just starting out with us?
You know, it's interesting. This was like 1990, was it?
1990.
Yeah. I had a real kind of breakthrough for me directorially the year before that. I hadn't done much episodic, but I had done, it's funny, after the feature film, my first episodic job was Miami Vice. And I'm going to tell a little story to answer that question. I'll try to make it quick. But I really got hit upside the head. This was 1986. What I didn't know about filmmaking could fill a library. And I really got hit upside the head because, you know, film is a language. You really have to develop a fluency in it because it's like it's a communication that, you know, there's a grammar to it, everything. And then my next job was such a painful experience that I realized I hadn't really taken seriously how ready I had to be. And my next job, I just did exactly what you described. I realized I didn't really know how I saw things until I could just sit on the set by myself and just spend the weekend, exactly that, and just let the set speak to me, kind of dream the show in my head and try to figure everything out. And that gave me that really gave me a sense of security. About because you walk on the set as a director, you take responsibility. And if you're not the leader, if you don't have a vision, if you don't, you know, have an understanding of how you want to tell the story, then everybody else is lost. And so that was fresh after that, Chuck. And that was very, I mean, I still to this day will spend time on sets. I need time to myself to really just eliminate distractions, consult, you know, find what really speaks to me and what wants to come out. So, yeah, that was right off the experience. It's a good memory.
Well, I think when you watch Gentle Art of Listening, and for me, right from the start, you know that something is different. Dan, the shot you took coming off the stairs, going down with the cheerleaders going and all of the activity out there, look at the 7 episodes before that. No one did anything like that. No one took that big of a risk. No one had assembled so much, purposeful action, you know, going here and there, and it really was. And with the, you know, the routines that the cheerleaders were doing, it got you. It felt like we really were in high school, right from the point of even Kelly Taylor and Donna Martin wanting to get out and go shopping because it's too rah rah. So from Beverly High is right on point, right?
Dan, for you, walking into this 90210 world, what are all the actors like at that time? They're all probably very young. It's a very new show. They're not necessarily developed in their characters yet by any means. So how are you walking through some of that in the early stages of this?
Yeah, it was really interesting because, yeah, what Chuck describes was, you know, I was very well aware of it. It was a situation, you know, chaotic situation. I remember actually at that time, there was no guarantee that I thought it was the 6th episode, but it must have been the 7th or 8th, something like that. There was no guarantee. I had a blast doing it, but there was real question whether the show was even going to air because there's question about whether the show was going to make it at all. So it didn't. It's really one of the amazing stories I've been associated with. You know, to catch lightning in a bottle like Beverly Hills 90210 did. I've had a few experiences. I was fortunate to be a trainee assistant director on Airplane, the movie. So that came out and suddenly everyone's seen E.T. I was the second AD on E.T. I directed the second episode of The Sopranos before anybody knew that was going to be, you know, The Sopranos. And 90210 was similar in that no one had any idea that it could become the sensation, international sensation that it became. To this day, Chuck, I got to tell you, you know, I'm fortunate I go speak sometimes at festivals literally around the world. But last summer, I guess, I went to Greece, and 90210 was like, a huge, huge thing there. It was really fun. But when I came in there, yeah, it was definitely, it was not the feeling of, it wasn't Miami Vice. It wasn't the shows that had kind of, you know, it was a struggling show, young actors, inexperienced actors, and there was a great energy to it, but there was a lot of the feeling of people hadn't been there. You know, they were kind of figuring it out themselves. I guess Jason had a little experience, but I'm not sure how much experience he had really had. So it was a real freshness, and it was and everybody, it was very well cast and good kids. And everybody, I will also say, everybody really wanted it to be good. No one was regarding this as anything other than a great opportunity. And particularly Dylan, Luke, I don't know if you guys have got into this, but, you know, I think Luke was people weren't sure about Luke in the first few episodes, you know, and I worried a little bit that got communicated to him, and he was pretty insecure. And he was so endearing. And so I remember he asked me to come talk to him in his trailer, and I was aware that there's rumblings. People really, can this guy really cut it or not? But he was so earnest and so wanted to be good and was just saying, you know, whatever I can do, and, you know, whatever you need from me. And each of the kids were great. And Paul Wagner was a real pro. Sadly, he passed away way too early. And so Paul really made the experience. And I was very friendly with Chuck. So, I know how talented Chuck is. So I knew, you know, this is going to be, there's some talent here. And Paul lent tremendous solidity to the whole process. He was really, I hope he's not an unsung hero. I hope he's a sung hero, because he really lent stability to the situation. I could tell I was coming into something that was not running smoothly, but Paul really had that sense of authority and taking responsibility. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The one term that you haven't used in describing, which was really did also determine what was non-union. I don't, you know, it was a non-union crew doing prime time in Los Angeles was unheard of.
Yeah.
You know, at that point.
But Paul was a pro. You're right. And he had the manner and the personality for easygoing yet firm and organized producing. And he was just, it was great.
Responsibility. I'm sure. I know he gave you, you guys, Chuck and Karen and, you know, and Larry, I know he gave you guys security because he was the perfect kind of line producer. I mean, I've run into a few more like him, but it's a rarity that people who just, you know, there's a there, you know, there's someone who will not promise something he can't do, but he will almost never say no because he'll figure out a way to make it happen. And you believe him. He was a straight talker. He would say no. You know, he would say, you know, if he had to, he said, sorry, you can't do this. And he was a storyteller, which is really what anybody in this business who is good at what they do has to consider themselves, has to be. Because, you know, he knew how to allocate resources in a way that would serve story. And he would, you know, go to bat if something might be costly, but it was really going to advance the story. And he would say no to something that was an extravagance that wasn't necessary.
Valerie says Shannon was experienced too, and we do see a lot of Shannon in this episode.
This was a Brenda episode, Pete. You know, back then there was a Brandon episode followed by a Brenda and a Brandon and a Brenda, and we had just come off the experiment of a parents episode.
Right.
So now we're going back. It's about Brenda, and I described that one shot how Dan got it going with the cheerleaders. The other thing, and I remember watching dailies with some very critical people in office, and you were shooting, and the way that you shot the first time that when Brenda picks up the phone and is listening for a long time about it, and you did the push, that was almost like a circular push, you know. Duke even said, without admitting it too much, that all we would have done was a straight, you know, shot. It would have been a stock shot. I mean, the camera would not have moved.
Yeah, you know, the way it's directing, we're all doing it for being storytellers, but the director is the chief one who has to tell the story. And what was really a fun challenge in that episode, I remember it was fun watching it again. God, it was, there was such innocence and all, it's such an appealing cast. I just loved Shannon in it. And I wanted to be a long shot that ended in a close shot. And that was why I did that circular move, because there was nothing to cut through, because the person on the other end is a mystery. Right. So there's another reason for keeping the camera moving, which is kind of keeps the intrigue and keeps the suspense. And by closing in, you kind of feel like the screws are tightening a little bit also. And you're getting into, you're getting closer to the truth as Brenda is getting closer to the truth, getting right. to an insight. You're moving and it replicates her inner journey, her subjective state, which is kind of.
And last thing I'll personally say about this one is that also relative to Brenda, it was important, and it really does set up the episode that follows, isn't it romantic? Because Brenda was really, okay, I'm in Beverly Hills and here are my friends and I'm getting used to being here. And this, but the way that Andrea Zuckerman would say, what are you doing here? Mm. Really how maybe the series was looking at her at that point. And she was, I'm smart, I'm capable, I'm legitimate. And one of the things that I feel we all suffer from is that she learned how to be a listener. And I thought that was an important thing to communicate. That if you listen to people.
In looking at the episode again, too, another thing I really appreciated is the characterizations. The relationship between Andrea and Brenda was very interesting, I think, because, you know, the show was kind of bold in the way it was not afraid to let a character be obnoxious, which Andrea was, but she never went into cliche. She was totally true to her character in kind of feeling like, who, like you said, Chuck, who are you coming in and doing this?
Yeah, very judgmental.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed watching and remembering how there was always truthfulness in both of the actors' performances so that it could open up to a real relationship, because they were never playing cliches. They were never playing false attitudes. They were playing attitudes that were really rooted in a very legitimate way, you know, rooted in their own character's experience, which kept them able to be responsive to things that would change their perception. I thought that was beautiful in that.
Also, just a note here. I mean, Shannon is really young in this, and I know she's had experience on some shows, but I mean, wow, is she impressive in this? I mean, she's doing so many things inside the episode, just the way that she handles the call and the way she's listening and whatnot. What was Shannon Doherty like back then, Dan?
I gotta say, I loved working with Shannon. I really, really did. And I did 20 episodes over the first 5 years, and really most of those the first 3 years. So I worked a ton with them all. And, you know, I know Shannon's reputation kind of blew up and all that kind of stuff. And people would ask me about it. And all I could say was, you know, I don't know how she is offset. Maybe that's where she's not comfortable, or maybe that's where some of these stories emanate. But on set, she was always a real pro, very directable, very smart actress, very subtle and sensitive. You know, one of those faces that you just have to think something and you're right there with her, unaffected. So she was all reliable for me. It's like I loved directing her, and I really loved watching her act.
Hey, Chuck, you said that you wrote this in what, did you say 3 days?
Yeah, weekend. Yeah, we were behind.
why did it come together so quickly for you?
Well, because I saw it as an episode of a cop show, quite frankly. You know, also there was also the QD story with the masseuse, and you think the older woman is going to get you, and you know, there it ends up being the teacher. So you know, there was no chance on that. But seriously, that it would come out and someone's in jeopardy, and whose it is it? And this, you know, there were other shows doing that kind. These weren't set in high school,
right?
And although. Karen would especially know that I didn't write that many hours of our television. I did some and I did follow it. So I knew how to do these kind of shows. And so we built the tension. Dan built the tension on it, you know. And also the idea, I also got in my head that that it had to be a popular girl, that it had to be a cheerleader, that we, you know, someone who's saying, oh, that girl's got it all. And high school after high school, you know, there are the popular crowd, you know, there are kids there who are always had been suffering, whether it was 1960s when we were there, Dan, or the 90s or now.
The actress that Lisa Dean Ryan, I think is her name, that she went on to play in the Doogie Howser show, I think, but she's really great in this, the girl that plays Bonnie. Do you remember working with her at all?
Yeah, I mean, it was a challenge. It was a very challenging part. I don't remember the casting process, but I do remember how important it was, I know, to me, and I'm sure to all the producers, that we find someone good, because that's such a challenging part, because you have to be able to enact so many different emotional states and the denial. And I was very moved watching it. I mean, just the feeling of the social pressure, and that I loved how, you know, at 10 o'clock at night, you know, her demon spoke to her and she was vulnerable, but, you know, in the school day, you would never know. And she did that really well, I thought. And she was.
To answer your question about Lisa Dean, I believe she came from Fox, that Fox thought it would be a good part for her, that they were interested in her and eventually put her in the class of when Mr. Spelling was so mad about that show, the college, Goldberg did it. And it was called the class of 93 or whatever it was. Good.
Uh-huh. Was Peter Horton in that?
She was one of the stars of it.
Yeah. I mean, she's great in this though.
That boxed us in. They did a college show and there we were going into our second year of high school. So,
by the way,
another reason why Mr. didn't want us to go forward to college.
Did you?
And of course, that was. And just for the you showbiz people who keep notes on this, it was Leonard Goldberg who did that show to box him in.
Chuck, you probably had the same reaction I did many years ago. It's probably 10 years ago. God, when was Gentle Hearts? So that was like 20 years ago. So maybe 10 years ago, the guy who played the rapist now a sports commentator on Fox.
I think
he's Ryan O'Neill's son. Patrick O'Neill, I think, is his name. I think he is Ryan O'Neill's son, and he showed. Yeah, he did a great job too.
Fantastic.
I remember on some Dodger post game or some pregame, he was doing interviews, and I said, "Wow, you got out of jail, I guess." Or something.
Oh, that's great. I didn't realize. Had no idea.
Hey, Carol, last time you were on the show, you said that there wasn't many moments where Brandon and Cindy Walsh, that they didn't have many moments just alone together. In The Gentle Art of Listening, I believe they do have a scene together.
Jim is
out of town for some reason. And you guys have a chat about Brenda, who is getting all dramatic on you or all theatrical on you, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Jim's out of town or something.
Yeah. What was it like looking back on that scene?
We didn't want to pay him.
It sort of escaped you, you know, the last time of having a scene just with Jason.
Right. Well, I guess I was thinking more about a scene about the two of us rather than a scene where we're, you know, talking about when I, you know, I came back and did a guest star, and I think it was the 7th season, and we had a wonderful scene together. It was really fun. I enjoyed working with Jason. He was a wonderful director from the get-go, I thought. I watched as much of these shows as I could. And there's a lovely lady on this show. She's got like auburn hair and she seems to be the mother. She looked very familiar, but I couldn't place her. And I'm telling you, it's a blank up here.
I love it.
I got to say, I really enjoyed
this one about the teen line, though, because I think that's the kind of show that really started to bolster the reputation of the show as a show that wasn't afraid to deal with reality, to deal with real issues. And boy, that ending, that was great.
Well, it meant a lot. The person who snipped at my heels the most, actually, when it ended and said, "That's the best show we've done." And that was a compliment because he didn't have many other nice things to say before or after. I sound like fucking Trump, but I'm not carrying it. I promise. I don't care. That hurts that I wasn't, or Alan, I didn't get invited to the party, you know.
Right.
Don't go there.
Yeah. But Andrea is so great in this too, Gabrielle. And I just want to let everybody know that Andrea will be here, or Gabrielle will be here with us next Wednesday. So that should be a lot of fun. And while we're on that topic, I'm going to run a little promo because someone is going to get a chance to hang out with us and Gabrielle. So here's what you got to do.
Attention, West Beverly High. You have an essay due.
Don't you have a newspaper to edit?
On August 26th, Gabrielle Carteris is joining the Beverly Hills 90210 show, and you'll have a chance to join us for 5 minutes to ask her anything. So, what do you have to do? Submit a one-paragraph essay to Peter at BeverlyHills90210show.com on why you should be the chosen one to chat with her.
Sounds a little more exciting than digging for sand crabs all summer.
Pete, Charles, and Larry will pick their favorite of the bunch, and you'll get a chance to be on the show. So, all you budding Blaze newspaper reporters, put that pen to paper now. Dazzle us with your fandom for Gabby.
That's sweet.
All right, so just send me an email with your essay, and one of you will get a chance to join us next week. Dan, what about working with Gabrielle? I mean, you know, she's the president of SAG now. She's
Gabrielle was a lot of fun, and she was the oldest of all the cast. As I recall, she was like 10 years older than anybody else. Is that right, Chuck? I mean, or at least
something like that, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so it almost felt, I mean, you know, I did feel that she had a lot more maturity than some of the others, which is perfect for the part she was playing because she's a precocious character. So it was fine that she brought that worldly wisdom to it. She's a kick. She's great. I mean, I have only very fond memories of working with Gabrielle, and she was always game. And also, I love how she was always willing to, you know, like in Dental Art, she was willing to come off as obnoxious if she needed to, like that part. She didn't back away from it. She didn't editorialize about it. She didn't say, I'm not really like this as she was doing it. She just always commit to it. So, and that's why she's an indelible, really good character.
Ryan Thomas Brown wants to know how we're going to grade these essays. That's Months, who played Months on 90210. The old Chuck and Larry.
Spelling to Ryan, spelling counts.
Lily, I'm curious if you have any questions specifically for anybody about this episode before we hop into
the next. Yeah, we do. We do, actually. One of our viewers, Alicia Bogner, this is actually one of her favorite episodes, and it is for several of us as well. But she wants to know the follow-up with Bonnie. We see at the end that the guys get arrested, but we don't get to see Bonnie getting any help or counseling. What was the reasoning behind that? Several of us would have loved to see the follow-up and how Bonnie coped.
The truthful reason, first of all, our episode, two reasons. One, we were self-contained, so there was no follow-up afterwards. And second of all, we didn't have a weekly contract with her. So we were bringing her back to do the therapy episode.
And it's only 44 minutes, so how much can you squeeze in, you know?
I mean, I know that sounds glib. Tell the person, whoever it was, say, when we do bring BYOB and Brandon spends only a night in jail and it all goes away, that one I'll step up to and say, boy, did we blow that. But this one, you know, that she was really a guest star, and that's how we had to look at it and assume that she's. If you were on 90210 and you had a problem, you were getting counseling one way or the other, right, Jess? I mean,
we had a hospital wing that was dedicated to our broken characters.
So, similar question: why?
I'm sure there's a whole room just for Ray Pruitt, right?
And Emily Valentine visited. She stayed there for a while. We had people all off to the hospital. But I do think that there was a shot at the end, Dan, of somebody hugging her.
Yeah, I think she got hugged.
I think, wasn't that the lady who ran the teen line hugging her? Somebody tall and grown up looking.
Yeah, I was impressed. I was impressed how everybody got there in time. That was nice. But
yeah.
But I got to say, in answer to that, I think one thing that you know, everything Chuck said, that's the nature, especially then in single and episodic TV. But one thing that mitigated that problem a little bit for me, I thought was a nice touch in the script, was she benefited from the team line. She did say no at the end. So that there was a way in which, you know, at the end, she finally stood up to them.
She stood up to them.
And I think that kind of takes a curse off a little bit because she's got, you know, Brenda has helped her.
Yes. Go ahead, Lily. You have another one?
I do. So Zara Brown asks, what was the feedback from the network and from the audience after this episode aired?
We were allowed to stay on for another week. as I said, you know, they realized at this point that that there was that we could step it up, and certainly that lent the support to Isn't It Romantic the following week. And when you put those together and then have a car where your lead cracks up a car because he's drunk, you know, this is not your grandma's high school show.
Yeah, for sure. Those were those two episodes. Okay, are we guys ready to move on to Paris?
I actually have special feedback here from Lori McKenzie Ebersole. It's not necessarily a question, but she wants you guys to know that the episode, The Gentle Art of Listening, was a significantly important episode regarding date rape amongst teens. It's been an ongoing issue for many years, and the coverage on this sensitive topic was very impactful and important. Kudos for this attention to what had been a hushed and quiet shame for many young girls. And also, on a lighter note, the lady who played the teen line program also led the self-defense class that Cindy, Andrea, and Brenda took in season 3.
Oh, there you go. She's on her career doing something else worthwhile. Jessica, what did you have? You wanted to add something.
I just wanted to tell Dan how special it was to watch this episode for me, because if you really helped cement these characters. In this episode from season 1, they already were fully formed, and you were part of creating that sense that Steve Sanders was the same Steve Sanders in episode from season 1 as he continued to be. That really, I thought that was great. And in addition, I wondered, this may not be the time, Pete, that you want to do this, but I think it would be wonderful to hear you talk to the fans a little bit about the relationship between the director and the executive producer, you guys, who are also the writer, Chuck, but to talk about how much you discussed the scenes before you shot them. I was so impressed by the B story and the sexy stuff where the lines were all about herbal wraps, except it was so sexy how she was delivering it. And that Chuck must have written some of that, but you must have also said, this is how I want you to shoot it, Dan, or Dan said to Chuck, this is how I'm going to shoot it. That was terrific. It was just great.
More than that, Jessica, Chuck actually put on a wig and played that part. He was.
Dan, you're giving away all of my secrets, buddy.
Pete, what do you want to do? I can talk about that.
Yeah, later. No, please. I'd love that. That's great. Yeah.
You know, I definitely, and it leads into something else too. Well, the spelling company, the one thing that I got, and this again from Duke Vincent, was the tone meeting, was that, and it was the most important meeting that I did, and we're doing it right from the start because Duke told me to, and what it is you go through every line of the script and you basically say to the director, this is what I'm thinking. And Paul made it up to the whole game and said, you do have the conversation with the director in front of him. And it's really the three of us having it, even though I'm leading it. And of course, if the writer would be in this case, I was both, but the writer would be there too. And all of Larry, Karen, and Jessica had that experience of being the writer in the tone meetings. And what it is, why it's important for Paul, it's a defensive thing for a producer, quite frankly, because not someone like Dan, but oftentimes a director has been known to say, well, the executive producer told me I could do it, so we should be able to do it. But if the producer was in every conversation, the director cannot say that and get away with it. So that was a spelling. Karen?
I just want to say how important that was from the writer's perspective, because, you know, your first draft's usually too long, And you want to cut it back as you go, you know, you want to tighten it up once you see what's strongest and what's staying and what you have to cover. But one thing that gets cut a lot in this is the stage directions to make room for the dialogue that you actually need. And so you don't have the luxury of just any page count. They really take the page count seriously. There's no room for just description that takes up no time. So that to me was what the tone meeting did to describe sort of the atmosphere. This is a jocular scene, not a tense, stressful one or something. You know, usually it's apparent, but you know, if you're in a hurry, you know, and you don't pay attention and it doesn't say the mood or, you know, this particular line is the key line of the thing. You know what I mean? It just allows you to do stuff you might have put in a script if it was a screenplay for a movie.
The director's point of view of that. Chuck, did you want to say something first?
Yeah, no, but you go ahead because I'm.
Yeah. First of all, thank you very much for your kind words on that. You know, the tone meeting is always something that's vitally important to me. And, you know, sometimes shows, I don't recall when we did it on 90210, but I've since, you know, I always am lobbying for the tone meeting to happen early, as early in prep as possible. A lot of shows wait till all the prep is done and then do the tone meeting the day before you start shooting, which makes no sense because the tone meeting is where the director gets the sense. What I look for in a tone meeting is a sense of, you know, what is in the writer's mind? What are the intentions? What is the subtext? What is the point of, whose point of view is the scene? I try to approach them, and I'm sure I did this then, but, you know, I'll try to be as full of questions as I can and interpretations. You read the script, but I want to check them out. This feels to me. And what the value of it is, you know, this is an interpretive art. And the best producers, I think, understand that script is really only a skeleton. You know, there's no such thing as shooting the script. That would just be pictures of words on a page. I mean, you've got to make it come alive. So what, you know, I try to enter every show with is a deeply imbued sense of what are the values of the scene? What are we trying to get? Why is it in the script? What's the reason for it being here? What's the building block, the story building block that it represents? I'd like to know everything about the characters, and I'm sure that's what we did. I mean, because that's how I have to work, and Chuck and Karen, you know, love to share that kind of work on that same level. And then it's interpretive. Then it's like you can't just say do it this way. But once the director is filled with that sense, then you can trust your instincts. You can monitor how things feel in the moment, and is it giving the feeling that we're after? So.
Chuck, did you have something that you wanted to follow up on?
I want to jump into something in two episodes, just in season one, just briefly to mention. And Dan, they are East Side Story and April is the Cruelest Month. Oh, yeah. East Side Story, you used the word prep. And East Side Story, if you remember, was the first episode we were shooting coming back from Christmas. And we, a script was handed in that Dan read and said, you know, Chuck, this isn't as good as the last one I got. And indeed, the person who wrote that script submitted their resignation at that moment. And here was the script. And I was, you know, I've talked about the first 12, so burnt out. And Dan said, well, you know, I think you could probably do better, and don't worry if you don't have a script for me in prep. And Dan prepped off an outline that was written in like 2 to 3 days and very different was the episode you ended up seeing. And then came Christmas Vacation so thank you for that, Dan, because that was when Mr. Spelling ended up reading the script, his note back to me was, well, now you've done it. All of them have to be this book. And in some sense, you think, oh, that's a nice compliment. But we both know Mr. Spelling well enough to say, you fool. Okay, now we have to make all of them this good. There was that subtext, too. But I really want to shout out before giving it to Jessica to talk about what you said, one of your fave episodes, which was April is the Cruelest Month. Yeah. That when Christmas happened and I had to write the script, that script would not have been written without the lady in the box up there who helped me so much because I was just completely brain dead. She revised me.
You're talking about Jessica helped with East Side Story?
No, Karen. The other lady in the box. Karen was writing East Side Story.
Yeah, we have a number. I have like 17 credited episodes. I have a number of uncredited credits too for the early seasons there.
Yeah, a lot of showrunners have that issue.
Alicia posts this for from the episode we were talking about in the Gentle Art of Listening. That isn't it interesting that Brandon snubbed the younger girl at the beginning of the episode, and then he didn't get the older girl. So even that story was really.
Yeah, but he was nice to the younger girl then. He realized he became more human. That was good, Chris.
Oh, absolutely. I love that. Yeah. Okay, so are we ready to fly to Paris, guys, and talk about how Paris came to be? Yeah. So Chuck, talk to me about that. When do we decide that Donna and Brenda are going to Paris, and how do we kind of get into bringing Dan into that world? Are we going to shoot in Paris? Are there conversations like that happening, or what's going on?
Well, the idea that we were going to send him to Paris started when Luke Perry came in at the end of season two and said, you know, I'd like to do scenes with the blonde. So I think I can quote him on that. And the idea of the triangle came. And once we got that approved, it had to do the mice, you know, when the cat's away, the mice will play. And we were now doing well. And we're coming into the third season. And what that meant for us was we have more money to spend. As we talked about, we had very little to spend in season one and not much more to spend in season two. But you get to season three, and if you look at all the extras that we had on the back lot in Universal, you can see this is a different television show. And one of the reasons we got so many extras and why it looks so good is because they wouldn't let us go to Paris. And we had it all. My friend Jeff Melman was going to go there and shoot it. He was the director of the episode between the two that Dan did in the Paris episodes. And it would have been, you know, it would have been a few walk and talks in front of the Louvre. It would not have been the richness that we got from shooting on the back lot. And Dan, I hope you had the experience sometime of being on the back lot on the studio tour at Universal in those years when they would say, well, there are many things that have been done here. And then they would talk about 90210.
Yes, I was on that tour. I've experienced it.
We were very surprised.
Like, I don't think that's on the tour of the Huntington Gardens where we also filmed a lot of
the Rick stuff.
And the Hellington looked beautiful, by the way. You really and it was early enough in the season too that was still green there. It wasn't too hot shooting out in San Marino.
But Dan, you come in, this is, you know, obviously you've shot some stuff in season one and two, and then you come into season three and everybody has sort of grown up a little bit. I would imagine the characters are sort of, they're sort of getting to know themselves and whatnot. What is it like when you get to work on that particular season?
You mean the shift in kind of the zeitgeist in this? Well, that, you know, that was one of the amazing times where, you know, very young performers were thrust into such international fame that I'm frankly happily surprised how well they dealt with it. But there were some inflated self-regard going on, and but everybody, no one was malicious or anything else. Everybody was they're all good people.
So, plus, you know, they liked to be being at the beach. That was a fun place to shoot.
I think everybody really enjoyed it. I got caught up in the fun too. I enjoyed being associated with a show that was like, you know, so, you know, colleges would meet in their dorms to watch it on the night. It was all fun, you know. And the actors, you know, they were full of beans a little bit more. There was that. And you know, you adjust. I mean, all I can do as a director is deal with the reality in front of me. And I'm always trying to get a performance, and I, you know, it does no good to try to make somebody be other than they are. I want them to be themselves. So it's just a natural response of mine to just deal with them wherever they were. So I didn't really register how much they were different. I just was registering where they were in the moment and how can I get what I want from them. But it was really a kick. It was fun. And the Parisian stuff, the beach stuff was a blast. I mean, I guess we were filming. Yeah, we had to have been filming in the summer because I remember one July 4th bringing my little children down to the, coming into the Beverly Hills Beach Club to watch the fireworks and off the Santa Monica Pier. It was, and I live in Santa Monica, so it was just, you know, the best going down to work on it. And so I don't recall any problems. I think everybody was delighted that we were all doing so well.
Liz says the Paris episodes really take me back to being a carefree teenager in the summer. I think that everybody can sort of, all the fans of the show definitely can speak to that. There's something special about those episodes and Brenda falling in love with Reek. Right. I'm curious, what was it like working with Dean Cain? How did he come into the mix of this? Chuck, you said that there was someone else that was that might have been Dean Cain's Rick's part, right?
Yes, I believe that Dan may not remember this, but certainly Karen and I do. The Mark Kiley, who ended up coming back and being the journalism to Gil Myers in season three, we liked a lot. And Mr. Spelling said, you can have him for something else, but look at that Dean Cain. I mean, Dean, and especially, was very good looking, and Dan probably got the best performance he ever gave.
I don't want to lose sight of the fact that I'm sure it was in one of those two episodes that Peter Krause was in it.
You made Andrea very sexy, and she it all felt natural, and I was really pleased seeing that again. Because we wrote the stuff where they were home on the beach, and Karen wrote the stuff where they were off in Paris. And I, again, no memory at all. And so it was thrilling to see it all because, and it turned out great.
Yeah, I agree.
And it can I say something? Yeah, I just want to say, I'll share a moment with you all that I have direct memories of the time because some of the moments I still remember this day is so much fun. And one of those moments was at Universal when we stopped shooting episode 3. We were moving to episode 4 in the same day just to be, you know, efficient with location. And they turned over from Dan Attias to Jeff Melman or vice versa, who was another director, both friends of mine. And it was like watching a new dad come on to take care of this group of kids. You know, it was like the new dad came on the set, the new, you know, leader, and turned over the helm. And it was like, so you know, because everyone focuses a lot on the director. And then when he steps out, here's a new one, you know, and it was, and I love them both. And it was just, they both had a slightly different approach with the kids, a little different ambiance in this, you know what I mean? But I remember things like that. So it's so much fun in my experience with the show.
I should say you pinpointed one of the really interesting challenges of being a guest director on the TV, because you come in and you have to be the leader. You're the one temporary person there, and you're the leader, and you expect and you need to develop trust right away. I mean, actors are, you know, sussing you out. Can I trust this person? I mean, they're going to do it. I have no idea. So,
and you both have had decades long careers because you obviously have mastered that particular art.
You need to, or you won't survive. I just want to say about Peter Krause, it was so funny seeing that because I went on to direct him a lot in 6 Feet Under.
Oh God.
And it's like he was, I mean, just playing such a different kind of character was really fun to watch.
And when you were there in 6 Feet Under, you went up to him and reminisced about the Beverly Hills.
No, we definitely did.
And we did you really? I was teasing you.
Yeah. When you know someone and you come to, hey, Peter, how are you? You know,
we had actually. Like his first credit, so. Maybe? He was so young.
Our friend Sherry Weiss wanted to know if you told Dean Cain you'd be inviting him back later in the season. Was that something that you guys had talked about?
Oh, yes. I noticed in the French episode, first of all, that if you look at the first one, of course, that's in the back lot. And Dan staged the traffic and made it seem that it was a square and everything. And then in episode 5, when he's leaving to catch the cab and Brenda runs in to try to find him and sees him across the street and lets him go, Dan shot that when he shot the first episode, even though it was in the 5th episode. And I believe the following one starts when the girls are flying home and Brenda has a fantasy that she went on away with him. And Dan shot that, too, in the back plot there, that one, you know, moment. It was just a shot and a setup. It wasn't that you know, much of a thing, I don't think. But so for that, those three, for that extra one, immediately after, we had to book him for that because we knew we'd be using his face in that. And then we knew eventually he would come back. I'm not quite sure if we settled on the exact dates at that moment, but we could have. We did things like that. We were pretty organized. One of the reasons I brought up that East Side Story is because that was the only episode that we ever went into an episode without a script, without one being ready. Never made a director do what we made Dan do, which is prep off.
That's why, Chuck, that's why you were a very good showrunner, because that's what, you know, an appreciation for what prep really means is it enables everybody to do their job better. But I will say that back on that East Side Story thing, I mean, my bias is give me better material. If I can connect deeper to a story, I'm going to do a better job anyway. But we have the advantage, as you mentioned, of having the Christmas break. So I knew I'd have plenty of time to figure it out. So anyway.
Kevin wants to know, Brenda starts smoking in Paris. Why was that added to her character?
Karen, you want to get into that?
Yeah, sure. That was, I thought, a brilliant idea that Chuck had. And it was in line with the idea of planting a seed in an episode. And, you know, it's a serialized, you know, tactic, but that you plant it and then you can grow it and then you can deal with it later. And it seems organic and authentic. And, you know, we did, like, he very much wanted to address issues, and smoking is, you know, starts in teenagerdom, you know, that's when it starts. And, you know, it was such an important subject. So to do the way he envisioned it, you had to sort of show her get hooked and why. You know, it starts that first episode, Donna complains, her throat's sore from everyone smoking on the plane, and there's these anachronistic restaurant references now in the episode. Can you imagine people smoking on a plane now? I can't even. But at the time, that was going on, and having the cabbie smoke in the cab, it would never happen now. You know, all the
right.
It's changed so much. But at the time, it was just showing poop, poop, poop. But then how you kind of, you get used to it, they're all smoking, and how it insidious with so many people, right? It was an issue for so many kids, and that's how you get hooked by the time you're an adult. So but there was a lot of pushback on it. Could not really, you know, it was hard to push that through, to have it be like, she's going to have to quit later, but let's show her get hooked first so people can relate and then see her quit, and that'll be a great example. And that was such an argument. I don't know why that was such an argument. It seems like a no-brainer to me. It's because they want to separate some of the episodes and they didn't want to have a hanging reference to her smoking that wouldn't be resolved.
That's good. What you got?
It was more than that, though, because I remember a lot of arguments with Standards and Practices about that we couldn't deal with a message about negative behavior of any kind without showing the negative behavior. So if we want to do an episode about how it's bad to smoke, you're going to have to show somebody smoking before you can show them coughing and say it's bad. If you want to show somebody doing that drugs are terrible, as we do later in the intervention episodes, we see Dylan completely crumbling, you're going to have to show progression of the negative behavior. And every single one was an argument with either spelling or Standards and Practices or the network. And it was an ongoing battle that we tried to fight.
Karen, yeah, one of the fun things that you noticed in this episode is the brain, eating of the brain. Sorry, Chuck, go ahead.
I just have to finish it up because this was a loss. I lost the battle. The biggest fight I got in with Dan McDermott was over the cigarettes. And we had to do that one awful episode, have it be done in one, one episode. And it was, I didn't believe she was addicted. No, but I mean, I wanted to go on for 15 episodes. I wanted her friends to shun her. I wanted to do the other thing, the snaking. I quit, then you go back to it. What it really is to be a young person smoking, which Karen, Jessica, and I, and Larry, all, Dan was a good boy, but we all knew what it was to be the high school smoker. And it always made me feel very unsettled that we did not get that out and really have the impact that
Well, can I know, Peter, you were asking about the brains, which I will answer. I just also want to say, when you think about it, what Jessica was saying of how just the change in standards and practices and the change in what's allowed to be done when you think now, I mean, of the HBO shows and Sopranos and the behavior of the people where you're rooting for the villains of all time and you relate to them and approve, you almost approve their behavior. It just, you know, that wasn't the era we were coming off of. So that's why it really wasn't done then. But the
answer also, we were dealing with kids. Yeah. And one of the things that we always had to deal with is with drugs, for example, we couldn't show them actually ingesting. So like the camera had to be in the back of Dylan's head when he was smoking the heroin. Later on, we'll talk about that episode. But as I stayed in tween television after 90210, and this continued to be an ongoing thing throughout my 20 years or career. Go on, Chuck.
I just want to say also that we were just really a tobacco laden set. Shannon was a smoker. Luke was a smoker. Jason was a heavy smoker. And so it was like, guys, let's deal with what's going on around us here because we got to get a bit of fresh air.
Yeah. And for Karen, with the brains, writing the brains segment, that was brilliant. I think everybody sort of remembers part of Paris for those episodes for that. Do you remember writing that? And what was that like?
Totally remembered living it in Paris, my first trip to Paris, and ordering what I thought was veal, and it was Tête de Veau. It wasn't, and we used Cervelle de Veau, the actual name that would be on the menu, but, you know, in a restaurant where we were intimidated and I didn't speak quite enough good French, and the waiter was in a hurry, and we got the fish and the brains, and my husband did me the favor. He did not order the brains. He got the fish, and then he switched with me. So that was very,
very nice.
I did that very much. But I do recall, I'll confess after this, Dan in a tone meeting, he didn't like that joke. Is this really, I mean, haven't we seen this before? And Chuck was like, yeah, tell me where have we seen this? And it's like maybe Uncle Milty did something like that. I don't know, but you know, but he pulled it off. I thought they did great with it. I thought they did it very funny, and the little pieces they used of them spitting that out. I mean, I laughed out loud. So
I laughed.
I laughed too.
I also have to say you did a great job with a real deaf kid.
Yes. Oh,
thank you.
That was, I think, Chuck, that was a big deal that we hired a real deaf boy, and Dan directed him beautifully. And that was, I think, an important moment for the series as well, because it showed that we were trying to be inclusive.
Yeah.
We just were talking before you started the live, Jessica and I were reminiscing and Chuck, that our daughters were in that episode in the
club.
The very first 2-3 minute scenes is Brandon is buried up to his neck in the sand and he's going, hey guys, come on, let me on. And Lynn's going, we're having fun. My daughter, girl one and girl two. They are adorable. They're 8 years old. They're in the tug of rope. They're in the red rope. They were all through it, and I forgot that.
I forgot too. And there's my little girl running across the scene. So I want to thank you, Dan, because not only were they in it, you kept them in the cut and used them throughout. So it was very kind.
I was buttered on. And Randy Spelling was in it too.
And Randy Spelling.
Yeah, that was interesting.
There was a family episode.
Dan, I want to go back to the brains thing. It's interesting because. You know, Tori is so funny in those scenes, and she just rocks comedy. And then a little bit later on, one of the other episodes, she's so good at, you know, sometimes interpreting like drama and whatnot. What was it like working with Tori?
Tori had this really interesting, natural, effectless quality that I didn't direct it. I mean, she had it. You know, some things she could pull off, some things maybe not, but you know, but she always had a very unique authenticity to it that was just very, very particular to her. And I think that's why it worked when she do it. It just was something that was idiosyncratic to the way she responded to things. And I don't remember really, you know, needing to note her very much on those kind of moments. She has a real good instinctive sense of it.
Yeah. Hey, Larry, you were not a part of any of this, and you reviewed these episodes. Yes. Coming from it later on, and we're going to talk about that other episode. But what was your take looking at these episodes? I'm curious. I'm always curious about what you think about these things.
Well, you know, I mean, there's like a Rosetta Stone-like moment in the Wasserman Klein triangle. I mean, that just became what the template of the show was. The other thing I noticed in the early episodes there was a first season episode and the third season episode, and fifth season I was there. But in the first, all the actors seemed to be like trying to find out, defining their characters. And Brenda got defined in that gentle art of listening. That was really satisfying, I thought. I was totally shocked in the first episode of Too Little Too Late, of the Brandon getting cuckolded about this kiss with Andrea. I mean, come on, guys, what happened there? I was shocked, and I didn't see Sex Lies and Videotape or whatever, volleyball. So I don't know what happened to Brandon, but he seems like he really cares about it, because he goes way out of the way to kind of make her feel guilty about leaving for a job for a deaf kid that she's only met like a day ago. And so I got to believe that he really wanted to see her. And, you know, and I know she says to him, you know, you don't really have to, you lose it. But I had no idea there was heat between them. I was, you know, I'm glad I didn't see that episode. But it really confused me. And I love the guy playing Jay, who is Peter Krause. I thought the kiss was one of the best kisses. Dan, you have a lot of kisses in these shows, which is fabulous. And the French kiss, must have really got the kids going, I thought. That was really a seminal moment. So I love the Paris stuff. I don't want to take up too much time because I didn't do it, but I really felt like this is setting the roots of the show up in those early episodes and who the characters were. And when that triangle hits, that became the series. The other thing I noticed was, we always talk about the template being emotion, passion, bonding, fun. But there was another thing which Chuck always brought to it, which was a social conscience. And that really plays in it. So you had a combination of beautiful people, you had the fun we had, and then you had the social conscious stuff. And that's what made the show so special, I think. There was really something there. The other thing was, by the time the summer episodes came, tell me if I'm wrong, Chuck, but you really were on the calendar at that point. So, which added another emotional reality to the show, because when it was summer, when you were watching, it was summer at home for you. When you're starting school, they were starting school. And it all made it seem realer and more vital.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Zara says Larry is preaching. So there. I think she means it in a good way.
Not to the choir.
Just footnote. Well, no,
I saw the show basically being formed there. I mean, I just really had, you know, you see the elements of it, and, you know, some people, you know, and also as Chuck and Peter and I talked about in the season one, it was called like a show that has no memory, because they were really standalone episodes. They were trying to really find and define the show. And then once everyone had the characters, then the important thing, and this happens also in number five, in the intervention scene, where all these callbacks happen for other episodes when they're trying to make Dylan remember how he saved them all. And that's what really made the fans get hooked onto the show, because the writers cared about what had happened before. And we referenced that in like little nuggets. You get little equity for watching every show.
Yeah. Val Marin says, loved when Andrea said, "What makes you think you're so damn irresistible?" I loved that line too. She says that.
See the jerk, she calls him too.
Yeah. Hey, Lily, do you have any questions about this Paris stuff? I know that you're going to probably ask something about a triangle.
Not too deep.
Okay.
But the ones I want to focus on are, we need to know, what was the actual food that was used in Donna and Brenda's brain dish? Was it really brains, or was it veal, or?
You know, it would have been whatever the prop people talked to Shannon and Tori about and said, these are the options that look like brains. What do you
like tofu to me?
I don't know what it was. Yeah. That's how it works in film.
Yeah.
The actors have to eat it, so they usually get to choose it. Right, Carol?
Can I just say, okay. I love brains.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
Yeah. I'm with you on that, Carol.
It's the texture that...
But with this went back to brains, it gives me an opportunity to confess that the night after the meal that Karen described, we went to a different restaurant, with a different menu and ordered brains again.
Choucroute. That means sauerkraut. We thought we were getting sauerkraut.
Lily, what else you got?
So, yeah, I'm going to avoid the triangle because I know that's not what we're getting into today. But did Shannon know any French during these episodes? And did Gabrielle already know any sign language?
Gabby did. Gabby did. Shannon didn't.
Shannon didn't know any French. So that's something they picked up for this.
Yes, we had a coach for the accent. And I did notice her accent got better from the first thing in the cab where she's speaking with no accent whatsoever, and then purposely, and then it got better and better as they were, the longer they were there and the more coaching.
And the drama coach was our friend Joshua Carton, who Dan knows as Gary Carton, and who was a good actor, but became more of a teacher of acting. And he, for the 90210 super fans, he's the one in the early episode that was the driving teacher, the first driving teacher you saw for Brenda. It was the same actor.
Oh, interesting. Lily, Sarah says Lily is a pro. Nobody does it better than her.
Thank you.
You deserve that.
Remember, Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
All right, let's move on to the last of the bunch that we talked about, the intervention. And I was able to find something. You guys are going to find this interesting. I pulled this clip from Entertainment Tonight Canada of Luke talking about this episode. So let's play this.
Was there something you did on that show that you're still sort of like, I can't believe we did that?
When they had me driving in the car smoking heroin.
Yeah.
I just thought that was a little much. In reality, heroin is a problem in that demographic, and it was starting to become so. But that, for me, I remember, because I remember doing the shot where I had to have the cameraman sitting on the back of the car, shooting over my shoulder so you could see that I had it in my hand and what I was doing, and also that the car was moving, to sort of heighten the danger element. Yeah. And I remember thinking, wow, this is crazy. This doesn't seem like a shot for our show. Hold the heroin pipe up a little and get the flame under it. Now, and I thought, it just doesn't seem like 90210. I mean.
So there you go. Wow. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad he didn't think it felt like 90210 because it shouldn't have. I was doing my best to make as edgy a show as possible, not to romanticize this or sentimentalize it. And in looking at it, I had actually forgotten the episode included him driving off the cliff. I was thinking, wait, he walks out. Then is this resolved in another episode? And when I watched it, I was really happy with how edgy and scary it was. And so it shouldn't have felt like an episode.
I would have reminded Luke that he was the one that pushed us to be edgy, 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 and made us feel very sophomoric when we weren't. You probably forgot that in that interview in Canada.
I was so touched seeing him. Do you know how many years ago that was done? That
I don't. I think it's about 3 or 4 years ago when they
to the end for
it. Yeah, it was for sure. Dan, I wanted to ask you what it was like working with Luke Perry.
Luke is my wife to this day. Adores Luke, and I. He's. He was one of the gentlest souls, and to have the kind of stardom. I remember in the second or third season, he'd come back. Oh, I just was flown by Madonna to join her, and it's like how he became, as I'm sure the fans know, he was a real heartthrob, and I felt that watching these episodes. I could see, my God, he was appealing, charismatic, and he always was down to earth.
Yeah.
He really was a serious actor. He really wanted it to be good. He really wanted to take chances and risks. And you see that in his career choices afterwards. He did some very edgy things from Orange is the New Black to
Oz.
It wasn't Orange is the
New Black. Rocky Horror Show he did.
And Buffy and all that. He always was really wanting to soak up experience, have experience. He was just a beautiful soul and easy to work with. Not easy in the sense he was very challenging. He was constantly challenging me, always be on my game, and And I love that about him.
Carol, you were going to say?
He's just a very grounded human being from the get-go. And with all of that, I think you're right, Dan. I mean, it's remarkable. Yeah. All the fame and fancy stuff he got going into. You go to his memorial service, and it's his best, oldest friends who are telling stories about him.
Yeah.
And one that was very touching. One thing I learned was that he knew from a very young age that he was meant to be doing, to be an actor and be up on the screen, like a very early age in an environment where it was definitely an outlier, you know, it wasn't what everybody was doing in his community necessarily, but he said, I'm going to be doing it.
I want to say too, looking at these episodes, I don't want the show to be over without my saying how much I adore Jason Priestley too. And I frankly was very touched looking at Gentle Art because, you know, he was so fresh and carefree then. I think frankly he got a little burdened during the run of the show with having to be the do-gooder and all that, because it's not Jason.
I only gave Jason one note. And the whole time, which was when he complained, it was early on in the second season. He said, I don't get the guys. And Jason, just think of what I would be saying. Think of Brandon as me. It is me as the designated driver with everybody in the backseat tripping.
That's not who Jason really is. And I felt like, you know, he did a great job. And Chuck, you're a very dramatically worthy character. I don't mean to say that, but Jason's essential nature is much more of a bad boy and just a guy who loves to just, you know,
cut up.
Sherry, again, hello, Sherry. We got you two questions today.
Yeah.
She also brings up this really beautiful scene in Intervention with Luke and Carol when Cindy convinces Dylan to go back to the house. Remember doing that with him? And
I remember the house. That was a fabulous house. The exterior was like right down the street from the exterior of the Walsh house. But I always loved working with Luke. He was so there. He was so easy, back and forth with. I relished every moment on screen.
Let me compliment you too. I was about to say, when I looked at the episode again, I was so impressed with Luke's performance. It seemed so raw and authentic, and you really kicked it off too, Carol. Because I thought for that to work, the way you came over and got him to come over to the house, there was just real mutual respect and real authenticity and restraint, which was appropriate in that kind of moment, and a sober kind of, make a pun, but a sober reflection of how difficult this problem was and how you didn't really have control, but you were going to do your best. It was really good.
I got a question for you, Jess. Was this a hard episode to write for you guys? Particularly hard?
Are you asking me?
Yes, you and Steve. I mean, you're doing
it's
this.
A hard, it, I must say, Chuck, it was hard to write, and it was even harder to watch. I'm glad to say that we did have Mackenzie Phillips. What's her name? Phillips?
Mackenzie
Phillips was a real life alcoholism and drug addiction counselor. So we were able to use her skills as well as her acting, but she had come up through the rooms, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I've spent time in the rooms since, and I think we did a very good job with this episode. Yeah. It was hard. It was hard to write and hard to film. Really good job, Dan.
Well, it had the feeling of authenticity. And as I recall, Mackenzie was her first job since she got out of rehab, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Also, you know, the one thing to remember is that, you know, when the hardest thing the directors used to tell us on 90210 was to do the group scenes in the peach pit. We had to shoot it in this because they're there and they're sitting in this. But this one, you had the whole group, and yet, you know, in a more dramatic environment. There wasn't, was there Remember, was this one of them too that everybody, nobody was trying to crack each other up? Was it a?
Oh no, no. You know what was? I remember from that is everybody was aware. It was a very important episode to Luke because he was really getting to play something with meat on the bone, and everybody was loved Luke and really wanted to be supportive of him. So there was absolutely, as I recall, only support and trying to create the right environment for him. And Jess, I just want to tell you, I thought the writing was superb because in watching it, it had a very real and edgy moment-to-moment just volatility. Like, is he going to stay? Is he going to go? And Luke did a great job of really playing that line. And he couldn't be an easy mark. He had to be a really tough one. And I just really admired it. Like when he almost got out the door and then Steve Sanders says, screw you can go, who cares, I don't give it, And it's like,
what was that line? Because I don't remember that line being written that Steve says, why don't you go back to the bottle that you crawled out of or something like that.
Yeah.
I might have improvised that line.
I don't know. What impressed me so much, because it's always what I'm looking for and hoping for, is just the feeling of things that kind of happen in a surprising way. And I didn't know how they were going to stop him from leaving. I've forgotten without it being some false beat. And it was just beautiful because he was almost out the door. And then he thought, wait a minute, this guy I cared about is still angry at me. He didn't want anybody to really be angry at him in any way. And it's like that kind of, it was just woven very, very excitedly.
Hey, Dan, I played that clip of Luke talking about his version of how that played out and the camera behind him and all that stuff. Do you remember your version of that? What was that like to do?
Well, I just remember, I know how I work. I don't remember specifically. I was glad Jess reminded me that. I was wondering, I was thinking, well, that was kind of artful how I never see anybody taking drugs. We did cocaine in the mirror. We went down and tilted up. And by the time it got to the mirror, he had already done the second nostril. And I was thinking, why didn't I get back to see him actually do it? Well, it's interesting, And they reminded me how it was a great choice. I actually prefer it. But I'm just trying to create as visceral an experience as possible. So I've done that many times. It's like wanting to have a handheld camera, the driver's point of view, the shaky quality of it all. I was aware that it was not an easy stunt. I don't recall the stunt, but I was thinking, wow, to have somebody free driving and actually, I don't imagine we had a stunt double doing that through the windshield that kind of went up onto the dirt thing and turned around. And
The prop people did a fabulous job with the drugs, by the way. Sad to say, I know too well. That was unfortunately very realistic.
I think that was a gift because I think it makes it meaningful, and I'm glad I'm moved by how it's touching you, and I hope it touched others too, because you want to have your story told, you want to be seen, and you want to have some compassion in the film, which I think is so beautiful.
I think it did a very good job of not sugarcoating the path of addiction. And they got him in, but they didn't keep him there. He hadn't hit bottom yet, and he literally is hitting bottom when he drives his car off a cliff.
Yeah.
But that journey is going to continue.
Yeah. Hey, Lily, what fan questions do you have for this?
Not for intervention. None.
Okay. I wanted to say that we will cover the triangle.
Carol, I
definitely see her. Somebody asked about the triangle. We're going to do a triangle episode, so that's why we're not really talking about it here. But anyway, Carol.
We need a lot of time to talk about that one.
Okay.
I do remember doing the intervention scene, and I think it's partly because we were all together, and it was really fun to work with everybody in the room, and we were all focused. And I mean, you know, Danny's right. We all cared about the scene. I think everybody knew how important this issue was, and we felt good about talking about it in this on this platform. And so, you know, when you're in a scene like it takes a long time for all of those shots and everything. So we really, even, you know, we weren't joking around, but we were hanging out together. And, you know, as a parent, that was kind of rare. There aren't that many big scenes where everybody's either over at the Walsh house and the parents are there, or there's a wedding or there's some other big event that everybody's at. And so those, I really enjoyed those opportunities a lot.
Yeah, for sure. Guys, this has been great to talk about all this stuff. I want to mention one other thing. I'm going to go here because this is a campaign we have to get on the Kathleen Robertson on the show. But I think she's absolutely phenomenal in this episode. There's that whole bit about her and David with the tape. And then Dr. Martin sees the tape, but he, you know, like says, you owe me one or whatever. I mean, some really great stuff. I'm going to run a promo because we want Kathleen Robertson to see this. So here we go.
Hey, Kathleen Robertson.
Guess who?
Yeah, you.
I'm out of here.
Claire Arnold.
Hi.
We want you to come on to the Beverly Hills 90210 show.
I'd rather jump overboard. Sentence.
You're smart.
What?
Your eye rolls are epic. And your acting is incredible.
Thanks.
We want to dive deep with you on all things Claire Arnold. The hosts want you on.
My, like, TV crush is Claire Arnold.
I don't know.
The writers want you on.
And it was registering on all cylinders.
Your co-stars want you on.
Kathleen was great, man. Kathleen's awesome. She's a Canadian.
The fans do, too.
Kathleen, will you please go on Beverly Hills Podcast?
Besides, I'm a Canadian. You're a Canadian.
Have you asked her?
So we're asking. Have your people chat with our people. Fans, don't give up.
Absolutely not.
So there we go.
I love that.
One thing that we should mention, there's also the great scene which Dan did, that whole Ray Pruitt having dinner at the Martin house is phenomenal. It is so classic Catherine Cannon. We've got to see it, but we also got to see Ray's house in Rosita. It was just really very poignant. You know, Carol McWilliams, who's passed away, plays Ray's mother, Luann, and it's just really good background for Ray. It was a good. It was good. It was slumming.
Yeah, it's really nice too. And yeah, I'm sorry, Dan.
No, I was just saying. I really enjoyed looking at that stuff again. I really appreciated Ray's performance. He had a lot of dignity. I really love that. It's great.
Also, like Tori and Ray on the back of the pickup truck, and just that like sweet conversation that they have, and you know, she's really opening up and whatnot. I mean, beautiful stuff that you did. And the pickup truck is like this beautiful, like scenic sort of thing. I guess a beautiful like location, right?
And also a nice pointer to the difference in the social class.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, guys, I think we covered these episodes pretty good. Dan, thank you so much for being here. I mean, the work is so incredible. And I always try to say a little bit of gratitude to everybody, you know, that comes on the show. There's a boatload of 90210 fans here that are still plugged in to this very second, you know, that are just so appreciative to everything that you did. You brought our favorite characters to life. And it's all these years later, and we still watch it. We still love it. And I know your work goes beyond Beverly Hills 90210. You always bring something very special to what you do. So thank you for popping on here too. Yeah, and thank you for the panel. It was great having everybody here. We'll be back with two episodes next week, right, Larry? We've got Gabrielle on Wednesday, and then we've got
The Essential Susan Keith
on Friday. So you'll see that promo coming.
With Emma Caulfield.
Emma Caulfield will be with us on Friday. So, all right, guys, thanks so much for doing this, and we will see you next time.
Bye-bye, sweetheart.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.